Well, good evening. This is Ray Hill, and we're on KPFT Houston HD2 channel, bringing you what is normally called our Texas Execution Watch. And Texas Execution Watch is a program that we do regularly every time there is an execution in Texas. Tonight's execution is Leon Dorsey. And Leon does not present us with a very pretty case, and we're going to be talking about some of that as things continue. And so Leon Dorsey is a gangster, and he committed a crime. He's out of Waco originally, and he committed a crime in a video retail store, in which two people
were killed. Dave Persenese.
It was pretty well recorded.
BBC News with David Legg. President Sarkozy of France, who's leading mediation efforts to end the conflict over South Ossetia, has agreed an outline plan with...
when they finally connected that. And we have with us Jim Skelton, who's going to be talking about the case and how it evolved and the appellate procedures. We've got in Huntsville, we've got Professor Dennis Longmire, who is up there. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's going on there? You are, I trust, in the street in front of the Walls unit, the Huntsville unit.
That's correct. I am standing in front of the Walls unit right now. Just about 2 minutes ago, all of the witnesses for the media crossed across the street and entered into the Walls unit, which is the signal that the execution is going forward as scheduled. Right now, as we speak, members of Leon's family and friends who are going to be witnessing tonight's execution are walking up the stairs of the Walls unit being escorted by correctional officers. I'll count them. 1, 2, 3, 4. Four people who appear to be members of Leon's family. 2 others, 3 others going in that look like they may be correctional officers, staff, or prison workers.
Uh-huh.
So they have all entered the building, which is the signal that we have telling us that the execution is going forward as scheduled.
Going forward as scheduled. And by we, what kind of crowd is out there demonstrating?
There are 7 people who are regular witnesses to the execution, regular vigil members to the execution who are here. There is also a film crew from France who is doing a film. They're putting together a film just highlighting Texas as kind of the center point for a lot of issues that seem to be facing the world at large, global warming, issues around the economy, and also issues around crime and justice. And so they are here on the corner making a video.
Is there other media?
There are no other media in sight. There are 2, 4, 6, 8. There are 8 security guards that work for the prison system standing across the street in a small huddle. Looks like just having random talk. And it looks like about another 5 of them are up about 100 yards away from us, also huddled together, not apparently interested in anything except their small conversation.
And you're not in a position where you can see Leon Dorsey?
No, absolutely not. We are actually situated on the northwest corner of the prison itself, and the execution takes place on the northeast section. So we are about a block, about a city block away from the execution chamber. We can see the guard tower that overlooks the execution chamber, so we are within visual sight of that. There is a prison guard standing on the picket just across from us. He's about 20 yards from us and then up in the top of the prison watchtower, and he has his shotgun on his shoulder and is standing out watching us to make sure we don't do anything radical or anything more radical than standing on the corner.
And, Dennis, you're a professor at Sam Houston State University?
That's correct.
And are you a regular person at these executions?
I am. I have been coming to the corner in opposition to the death penalty since 1984. I have been to probably 90% of the executions that we've carried out, and a lot of executions that ended up getting stayed or postponed, and some of them actually stopped forever. And so whenever I come to the corner, I come with a hopeful imagination that the execution won't go forward, I'm usually disappointed, but I always have that prayer and that hope in my heart that we will stop and stop for good.
Well, Texas Execution Watch at KPFT thanks you for your services for this purpose. You have, I believe, Elizabeth's cell phone number. If something happens extraordinary, please get in touch with us, and we'll be in touch with you later.
Thank you for your coverage of this, and hopefully word will get out to people, and eventually we will get sane about our efforts to administer justice in this state.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And that was Professor Dennis Longmire from Sam Houston State University. And he is watching what's going on across the Vista in front of the Walls Unit in Texas Death Machine, which is located in Huntsville, Texas, and all that. Jim, what can you tell us about the case?
Well, first off, let me explain some stuff about his background. And this guy is one of the more unusual people on death row because apparently he's fairly bright. And there was no evidence, at least I could uncover, and in the stuff I read, that he came from a troubled background. He stayed in trouble pretty much all the time. As a matter of fact, he was accused of stabbing some kid in Pee Wee League. He's the only person I've ever known, except perhaps one of the lawyer I know, who was kicked out of kindergarten. And he got expelled from kindergarten, and he tried to burn his babysitter's house when he was 10 years old and shot a gun in school. And also he bragged about being expelled from Germany, expelled from South Dakota. Apparently his mother was a master sergeant in Germany, and they invited him to leave the country. And then apparently in South Dakota he was put in some sort of rehab deal, and they invited him to leave South Dakota. And on this particular case, he went into a video store and shot and killed two people. And the case went unsolved for something like 4 years. And what happened, he was in jail doing a 60-year term for killing a Korean lady in another robbery. And in the interim, what had happened, he apparently told four or five different people that he committed the killing. And initially, his girlfriend told the police that he was the one that did the killing in the video store, but they didn't think his description matched up with the video. The video was somewhat grainy. And so they kind of let it go, and then 4 years later, after he got put in the pen for killing a 51-year-old Korean lady in another robbery, they go to Huntsville and interview him. He confessed to this. In fact, he bragged to the police that he had also committed a number of other capital murders or capital crimes. It was up to them to solve it. He was going to help them do their job. And what really hurt him a great deal is his defense lawyer pointed out, he's talked about killing those two kids in the video stores like losing $1,000 in a crap game. And so what happened, it was affirmed on direct appeal. And here's what's kind of unusual about that part. Whenever you're convicted at the district court level, you automatically go to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And a vast majority of death penalty opinions are published, meaning when they're published, what that basically means is that it's authority for other lawyers to use those opinions. Mm-hmm. If it's non-published, that means it can't be cited as authority. And what they're basically saying when they don't publish opinion, there's nothing unique or unusual about the issues raised that's worthy of it being published. Because mm-hmm. it's already been decided. So I was not able to locate the non-published opinion by the Court of Criminal Appeals. After he published it, he then went to the U.S. Supreme Court on cert. They denied the writ of certiorari. He comes back in and files what we usually call 1107 writ in state court. That, too, was denied in another non-published opinion, which basically tells you that the issues he raised were not unique or different or unusual. In fact, I hate to say this, it's kind of like a plain vanilla case of what they're basically telling you when it's unpublished. Now, he then goes to the Fifth Circuit, and they discuss three different issues in the Fifth Circuit. The first thing that happened, and this occasionally happened during a trial, apparently prior to trial, he gave an interview with a reporter from the Dallas Morning News. Mm-hmm. And in that, he bragged about the number of different capital murders he committed. Well, what happened, they were going to omit a portion of the tape, and lawyers love the word redacted. That just means take out. They can't say take out. That's too simple. I mean, if you spend that many
redacted.
Years. Yeah, they redacted. You know, that silly stuff goes.
Happens in radio, too, Jim.
Right. Anyway, they took out all the bad stuff about the other crimes he committed and then introduced the rest of the tape. Because lawyers often do, they had the entire tape marked for what they call purposes of the record, meaning that it goes up on appeal, the appellate court can look at the whole tape. But when they gathered up the evidence, somebody put in the full version, an 88-page transcript of the interview that had been redacted, supposedly, and threw it in the jury pile of evidence. Well, the jury had been deliberating about an hour and a half, and the foreman sends out a note and says, wait a minute, we got some evidence here that we didn't see at trial. What should we do?
Oh, my God.
And then there's this big dither. So what happens, the judge calls everybody out and interviews all 12 jurors, and here's what it turns out. One lady read 11 pages, she said, of the 88-page transcript of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And she said once she realized that this was something that had not been testified to, she went, now this is kind of hard to believe, but she said she goes to one side and calls the foreman secretly over and tells him not to alert the other jurors. Foreman then sends a note to the judge. So he pulls all the jurors, and it turns out that the lady who read it was the only one who read it. The foreman was just told it had been read. Two said they had seen it, and the rest of them said they were unaware of it. And then they do that wonderful thing that judges seem to think they can do. They said, you're not to consider this for any reason. You know, I just burned your house down and killed your wife, but don't consider that. Just kind of, right. You know, kind of forget that. You know, erase it from your mind, which is stupid. Anyway, this lady said, oh, I can do that. I can ignore all this stuff I read and all the robberies he did and all the killings. I can ignore all that. So she raised her right hand and said, yeah, she could certainly forget all of that. All the other jurors said the same thing. We can follow the judge's instructions. Well, that was an issue at the Fifth Circuit. And what the Fifth Circuit said, since this is a collateral tag, what that basically means is it's not a direct appeal. Mm-hmm. And you have limit to have a harsher standard to show. And they said you got to show substantial evidence that you were influenced, the juror was influenced by this particular reading this transcript. And they said, well, it was harmless error because he confessed to four different people who committed the murder. Plus, at that time, the videotape showed a description given by the people who said he confessed to the murder. And they said that was sufficient evidence to overcome any type of harm that might have been done by the transcript. And next thing that came up, the next thing he argued about, there was what we call a Batson issue. Batson issue is when they strike a minority member of the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And they simply said that had not been brought up on direct appeal. Let me explain what that means. Whenever you get a capital case and you go up on a direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals, you've got to put everything in the direct appeal that's later used for writ purposes. If it's not in the direct appeal, you can't use it for a writ. Forget it. And so it was not mentioned during the direct appeal. And then the next thing he argued about, they selected juries in Dallas County who were inclined to give the death penalty. And here's how this works. And this happens all the time. A juror will take the stand and says, any time I find somebody guilty of a murder, I'm going to kill him. Real simple. Okay. And then the judge says, now, wait a minute. And what he'll do, he'll explain all the rigmarole you've got to go through and says, if I instruct you, could you consider mitigating evidence? Could you consider blah, blah, blah? And the juror will always back down and say, yeah, I could consider that. Therefore, he's qualified. And he argued about that, and they said that had not been preserved for error also. So the Fifth Circuit basically flushed all of his arguments out, and the Supreme Court denied certiorari on that, and there's been nothing filed since then.
Actually, this is not a very old case.
No. No. It's gone through that rapidly, and he's kind of helped it along, because when he was on death row, I think he had something like 95 different infractions. He even made a shank and stabbed a guard 14 times on death row. Didn't kill the guard, but he certainly tried to. And then they found him not long ago with another shank inside of his cell. So he hasn't done a whole lot to help himself.
Well, you know, I think that whenever we get these cases, because we're down here talking about these things one at a time, suddenly come to the realization that we're not talking about people with nice, tidy, middle-class lives.
In fact, when I was reading the opinions, I was thinking about that line that Gus McRae said in Lonesome Dove, and he's hanging a guy from Missouri. For some reason, Missouri produced a lot of bad folks. He said, you know what?
Kind of like Texas.
Well, Missouri's even worse than Texas. And he said, I think it's because it's a rectangular state. That something does something to people's brains when they have those square corners to contend with. I've attributed to that in Republicans, but nonetheless, what he said was, you know, hanging you is kind of a pleasure. You don't make this too hard for me to take care of this. Well, I'm afraid Dorsey, no one's going to be
very easy.
He's made it real easy for people who want to kill him.
Well, there was some talk today that he had put out, Michelle Lyons of the Public Information Office has put out a statement that Dorsey was not going to go quietly to the execution chambers.
As a matter of fact, when I was reading these opinions, I was going to predict that he would create a problem. I just can't imagine him going blissfully. Because he is, according to what he says, he considers him a notch a little bit brighter than most people and seems to be somewhat contemptuous of people. In fact, he talked about how much he hated authority, and a lot of us hate authority.
Sure.
But
or at least distrust it.
Yeah. And he talked a lot about that, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he'd create a ruckus prior to going. That wouldn't surprise me in the least.
You know, that actually happens rather rarely.
I understand.
And so I think the cultural manifestation is the chaplain comes in and says you're going to do this like a man and all of that to make it easier on the guards and all that. But we have known several people who have put up a struggle. We will not know anything about that until it will get reported later, because that is the curtain behind which we do not peek.
Right.
And the chaplain knows, and the, of course, employees knows, and he will not survive the experience. So we'll be hearing about that later on. Texas executes a lot of people, because we're going to do another one of these next Thursday. This coming Thursday, in just 2 days, we've got another execution. Whenever they've gone into business with Texas Execution Chamber, it moves quite along. A little later on the program, this guy professed to have something to do with gangs.
He said he formed a gang when he claimed to be the one organizing a gang, but I don't see him as your typical gang member, because he was the one that organized. In fact, years ago, John Steinbeck wrote a book called East of Eden.
Mm-hmm, I remember that.
And he theorized at the beginning of the book that we accept the fact that people are born with physical deformities, like, you know, two arms, two sure. legs, no arms. He said, by the same token, isn't it possible that people can be born with the part of their brain that doesn't work? And, in fact, Dorsey pretty well has implied this. He said to about himself that he just doesn't feel the way normal people feel. And it's one of those things. In fact, years ago there was a book written on the structure of the brain. There was a real famous case, I think it was back in the 20s, where a guy in a mining accident had a spike driven through his brain. He survived it. But he turned exactly the opposite. He'd been a milquetoast, mild-mannered man. After the brain injury, he was profane, almost as bad as a lawyer, if you can imagine someone being that horrible. He would have made a great lawyer.
Jim Skelton, who is a lawyer, has a lot of personal commentary about his peers in that profession.
Anyway, and you know, you wonder sometimes if people are born with a part of their brain that doesn't function like my brain and your brain functions. And
well, is this, you know, the bad seed theory? I mean, you're just born bad, intended to be bad, they're going to be bad. So, you know, if we could just identify them early enough, we could kill them quicker?
No, I think, for example, there's a book called What Makes Sammy Run by Bud Schulberg about a sociopathic guy who became a movie producer. And a lot of politicians.
This is another discredit.
Well, I'm just telling you, this would be a real valuable asset in being a politician. When you're amoral, a lot of sociopathic people, if you're killing people, they'd be great politicians. Because usually they're fairly bright, and they have no conscience or morality. And that sounds like most of the people that we've elected, doesn't it?
That's not what the result are almost elected, or they almost made it to the election.
And a lot of people that we consider sociopathic have been fairly successful, as long as they don't kill folks, don't let them hang around your kids and babysit.
Right.
But, you know, they're pretty successful because they have no morals. They don't give to hoots and holler.
They get well. You know,
right.
They get to make
right.
money. Jim, we've been doing this several weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the idea? Is this idea of doing a program about executions every time worth doing?
It's hard for me to gauge that until I know kind of who our audience is. I don't know if anybody listens to us, frankly. I have
well, no we've idea. Gotten up on an archive, so we probably have more listeners each time we do this show. And now we've got up an archive so that people can go to us after the show and follow the pattern. I think the archive is probably in the long run going to prove to be valuable. Because these things, the people that we execute are basically out of sight, out of mind after the execution. There are a few outstanding exceptions to that. Charlie Brooks was remembered by the French because he was the first to be executed in Texas after a long lull. And then other people are remembering people because of their political activism and all that. But Texas executes an awful lot of people.
Yes.
And they just get lost in the shuffle unless somebody bothers to leave a trail for them.
Let me tell you what I think the value of this program is. I think that it does a couple of things. Number one, I think that one of our jobs, and we need to do more about that, in fact, I intend to work with your website on this, is to educate people how the system works as far as the appellate process and what we're talking about. And secondly, and I say this about people like me who are opposed to the death penalty, one of my biggest complaints is a lot of people who are opposed to the death penalty will tell almost any outrageous lie in the world because they feel their cause is justified. And I think it's our obligation to straighten that up, and we can do it through this program.
Well, we're going to continue to do this for the foreseeable future, and it was kind of a concept that Elizabeth and I hashed around and created, and I'm just amazed at the kind of cooperation we're getting from so many good sources, Jim being one of them, and the other guests that we've had on the show, and we will continue to tap many of the same guests over and over. Well, actually, Jim's not a guest. He's a member of the collective that's doing this. The whole thing is produced by Elizabeth Stein, the electronic wizardry that allowed it to happen, and also the host of the last show we did is Otis McClay, who is a longtime Pacifican with the Pacific spirit bent in and knowledge of the knowledge of what's going on in Pacifica, both technically and content-wise. A little later in the show, we're going to have Rick Halperin on. Rick is an activist opposed to executions from Dallas. Pete Gonzalez may drop by. Pete is a gangster who is part of the Prison Show Collective, pulled-up gangster, I could say. And he is in the free world and spends a lot of time maintaining and working on his sobriety and keeping from falling into the same trap. And then we have Patricia Harrington, who is director of Houston's anti-gang office at Task Force here in Houston. And is this ready to go?
Yeah, he's on.
Okay. All right. Are you on? Hello?
I'm here, Ray.
Okay. Professor Longmire, could tell us what's happening.
We are still standing on the corner, and nothing on the corner has changed. I was just explaining to the French film crew that this is about the time that we will expect the witnesses who did go in to start filtering back out. And that then is the only sign we have that the execution has actually taken place.
Well, that's why I suggested Elizabeth give you a call, is because this is about the timing, and if...
Right. Normally in the newspaper when you read, if the execution started at 6 o'clock on time, which this one did, normally you read that the time of death will be 6:19 or 6:20. So we're very, very close to that normal time period. Sometimes it takes longer for the prison officials to be able to get a vein, an active vein, and to have to put two catheters in the offender. They call him the condemned.
Yeah.
They have to get two veins in the condemned in order for them to be able to proceed. But if one of them blows out, they can immediately proceed to the next one.
Well,
there are two other people walking toward us right now, and they have come from the administration building area, so I don't know if they're connected with the prison, with the execution family or not. They're just walking by. This is not a very common area for people to be walking, and so I was wondering what there was, but they're just walking by.
Well, the thing about it is that we had received word earlier from Michelle Lyons, number one, that there were no appeals pending. So there's not any sudden changes in legal remedies that are subject to appeal. As far as we know, there wasn't even an application for clemency in this case.
Yeah, I had not heard about any possible appeals prior to my coming to the corner. I did conduct an earlier interview with someone. They asked me if I knew anything about a last-minute appeal that they heard had been filed, but I have not heard anything other than that question about it. I've not heard anything I do know that in this particular case, there was some question about a transcript that was given to the jury during the trial, during the deliberation.
We discussed that issue, but apparently that was given short shrift by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court denied cert on it.
I had understood that also had already been resolved. So we were literally waiting. There is a possibility that it has taken them long to find a vein in this particular case. It's possible that he is in some way resisting or resisted going in, so that might have been a problem. Somebody here had told me that they had heard him say he's not going to walk to the execution chamber without having to be forced to.
That was out earlier. We had information, and we broadcast it as speculative, and I announced that we would not know unless it would be reported by the chaplain or the employees after the fact.
Right. We won't know anything. When the family member walked in and went into the building, they saw us standing here. None of them acknowledged us. None of them waved or nodded a head or anything like that. And so I don't anticipate that they will walk down here when they finish. Usually, after they leave the walls unit, they walk across the street, go back into the main administration building, and gather their personal belongings, and go immediately to the funeral home, so that they can have an opportunity to touch their loved one while their loved one is still warm. As you know, Texas does not allow contact visits for anybody on death row, and so many times the family members are anxious and in great hopeful anticipation of being able to feel the warmth of their brother or their son or their father for the last time before they have to bury them.
And that's in contrast to the Louisiana practice that someone about to be executed is going to spend the last day, several days, in direct contact with their families.
Right. Texas does things very, very harshly. I was commenting to one of the people here, it's very odd because we pretend that we care enough about them to give them their last request for appeal. But if one of them were to ask for a kiss from his mother as his last appeal, they would deny that request because they don't want the physical contact to take place. The prison system and the people who work in the system have to have dehumanized the men before they can execute them. And that's part of that dehumanization process. They will deny them any physical comforts or physical contact at all.
Professor Longmire, there have been books written about Huntsville as prison city, and the culture is affected by what goes on there. Are you an observer of...
Certainly. As a professor of criminal justice, I'm very, very familiar with the culture of Huntsville, and it's the prison culture. It's not so much a death penalty culture, because most of the people in Huntsville, like most of the people throughout Texas, ignore these events. They don't know when there's an execution, and they don't care that there is an execution. So executions are kind of secondary. But it's a prison city. It's a city which is, and all of the oppressiveness of prison guards walking around in their uniforms and going to McDonald's to eat with their kids dressed in gray uniforms and wearing their hats and chewing tobacco, and all of that is very much a part of Huntsville. And it's an interesting scene right now. I wish you could see this because, like I said, there are seven of us on the corner opposing the death penalty. There are 9 internal security people who work for the Texas prison system standing around with guns strapped to their waists, drinking Cokes and eating popsicles or something of that sort. There are 2 prison guards with their hands in their pockets watching cars walk by. Everybody is kind of lulling around, and if I could do the math, I would calculate the salaries that we're wasting on this particular event just on the people standing on the corner, as if there has ever really been any serious threat to the security of the prison system that occurs from the death penalty opponents. Okay, Mike Grashuk has just walked out the door, which signaled to us that the execution has taken place. He's being followed by a reporter in a red shirt whom I don't recognize. And I suspect very quickly after that we're going to...
Now, Mike Grasek is himself a reporter?
Pardon?
Mike Grasek is himself a reporter?
Yes, he is a reporter for... He's a stringer, works for Associated Press, and he's a very, very regular witness to the executions. He's been witnessing and reporting on the executions since I came here, so it's been as long as I've been here.
So we can conclude, then, that the execution has taken place.
Yes, it's a safe conclusion that the execution took place, and I would imagine that Mike Grasek will get to his laptop within about 3 minutes and will file his story because it's probably mostly already been written.
One more question. As a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University, how much money did we spend to execute?
The estimates are hard to make, but it's been probably over $2 million in order for us to proceed with this execution, including the trial and all of the expenses associated with the appeal process. Leon's family is right now walking across the street. A huge Greyhound bus has just blocked my vision. But I see them walking in. They look exactly the way they look when they walk into the building as they do coming out. My suspicion is they're mortified and in shock, but that they were mortified and in shock before they went in.
So whatever the taxpayers invested in this operation were manifold multiplications of anything that he earned, stole, was worth in his lifetime.
There is no way that we can justify the expenses that are associated with this doing a cost efficiency or cost benefit analysis, because there's no way that we can ever monetize or put a financial association on a person's life, and we just took the life of a human being. And yeah, he may have been a murderer, or he was a murderer. I'm not even going to say speculatively. He was a murderer. He was an outlaw. He apparently took to his death with him the persona of a bad guy. But I still have hope in my heart and in my soul that people like that can be transformed. They will not be transformed as long as we threaten them with their life. We will never be able to reach the souls of the meanest of the mean as long as we promise to treat them meaner than they can be, than they can treat us.
Professor,
that's where I think the system ultimately fails like this, is that we set the Leon Dorseys up to be mean rather than trying to help them become compassionate and caring.
Professor Leon, Dennis Longmire, thank you very much for your services to Texas Execution Watch and KPFT.
Thank you.
And that was a chilling report, Mr. Skelton.
Yes, sir.
Jim, a lot of wisdom in that fellow's voice.
Yeah, and let me, you know, you mentioned this before, and I have a theory on that. You're talking about the ritual that they go through, and I think the reason for that, a lot of that, years ago, H.G. Wells wrote about the way that ritualized Christianity and religion, and it's a lot easier to go through a ritual than surrender your heart to a concept. And I think the reason they ritualize death penalty cases and have that strange ritual they go through of last meals, keeping track, it's a way to subvert your mind off of what you're doing onto a ritual, and you don't have to think about the person as being a person, because you're obsessed with the procedure of going through it correctly, and that way you cannot think about the person that's being put to death. And that's what rituals do for our society.
Well, I want to thank you for that, because I've been wrestling with that one. And the reason I'm wrestling with that one is because it seems such a weird set of circumstances to set that up and make that happen and then go over it again and again and again and again. And it was... And I said, my God, this is... like a religious ritual ceremony.
But see, when H.G. Wells wrote The Outline of History, he talked a lot about how they took the very essence of a lot of teachers like Buddha, like Christ, and ritualized what they thought, and therefore evolved to this bizarre thing we have to now with the guys that wear strange-looking hats and spread smoke. It's a lot easier to say a rosary and to say some chant than it is to surrender your heart to a concept. And so when Christianity became ritualized, it really lost its meaning. And I think the same thing is true here. In death penalty case, if you have a ritual and procedure you go through, that diverts your attention. You can be obsessed with the ritual and forget that there's people involved. Much like doctors never see patients. They see appendectomies and craniotomies. They don't see individuals. And sometimes lawyers are guilty of that. They don't see a person. They see armed robbers and murderers. They don't think about that as being a person.
And evidence.
Right.
And little piles.
Right.
That can either be covered up or
exactly. Exactly. And like I remember the movie The Elephant Man, he was screaming, "I am a human being." Well, see, the ritual keeps us from thinking about them being actually being persons. I think that's why they have the ritual. That's why they have the procedure.
Well, we're joined by Professor Rick Halpern from Southern Methodist University. Hi, Rick. This is Ray Hill.
Hi there. How you doing?
Oh, they have been letting me get away with most of it, but we have just completed and finalized another execution in Huntsville. Your thoughts?
It's a sad day. It can never be a positive moment when the state kills, regardless of the nature of the crime and how terrible the original crime was, to see the state resort to this violence in the name of supposed justice. It's always a sad day.
Well, Rick, you've been anguishing over this for a while. Why do we have to do so much more of it than anybody else? Are Texans as a class some horrible bunch of people that we've got to go through this ritual disposal of them in mass?
Well, I don't think we're any more horrible than anybody else. Clearly, our numbers are exorbitant compared to the rest of the country. But I think it's part of our culture as a people. It's clearly the usage of violence to solve problems, and I would put both of those words in quotes. America is always quick to want to use violence as a way to come to a resolution of an issue. I think it's in large part a cultural issue, a historical issue. It really is in large part who we are as a people. It's sad, but we really do love violence. We say we don't. We abhor it when it's inflicted against innocent people, but we really love it culturally.
And is it fair to say that revenge is just more violence with what the doer thinks is justification?
Well, in this case, that's clearly the case. Violence at the hands of the state. The state can call it justice or whatever it wants, but it is violence. It is an act of homicide. How can using a Nazi method of killing people be considered a nonviolent act? A lethal injection is a terrible, inhumane, repulsive, and repugnant act in and of itself. Now, violence is no answer to violence. It never has been, and it never will be.
Well, I thank you for sharing your thoughts with it, but I tell us about your work up there, Rick, because you've been working on these kinds of issues for a while. What do you teach, and what is your research background at SMU?
Well, I'm the director of the SMU Human Rights Education Program. We're one of only 14 universities in the entire country that have such a program. I'm very fortunate we get to work with young people, students who are interested in these issues. The death penalty is certainly one of the issues. We work with issues of refugees, hate crimes, genocide, torture, just a litany of all human rights issues that affect this world and affect this state and our country. We take trips 3 times a year to various parts of the world where human rights issues were paramount. So we just came back from a 10-day trip in Argentina, a country that was torn apart by 30,000 people disappeared in a military dictatorship in the 70s and 80s. Next summer we'll be in Rwanda. Every December we take a group to Poland and go through Holocaust sites around that country. It's, as you can imagine, pretty sobering, and it's a transformative experience. We've had groups in Cambodia, Bosnia, South Africa. We just want to get young people into this world to confront aspects of dark human behavior, because they're going to inherit these problems. Now, there's genocide going on today in Darfur, so these issues are not just relegated to the past where we're all having to deal with them. And I'm just very fortunate that we have a program here at SMU that allows our students to make a difference.
And, of course, those students also consider stuff closer to home like Texas executions.
To be sure, many are concerned about this issue. We have a lot of people who are working with attorneys on these issues. They work with victims of violence, just trying to come to grips with what is happening in their name.
Well, you know, literature is kind of catching up with us. I know I was on the phone talking to, I'm going to a film festival down here sponsored by the radio station, The Prison Show, and Rice University, called Prison Reform Film Festival. And among the films we're showing is Tulia, and Exonerated. Stories of wrongful convictions, stories of oppression, stories of fabricated evidence to take people's liberty away, and those kinds of issues. Doesn't that fit into the same gestalt and pattern of maybe certainly on a lesser level, but what's the difference of taking everybody a life away in a Holocaust in mass and taking liberty away with false evidence and fabricated convictions? Is there a difference between all of life and part of life?
Well, I think you're right on target, Ray. Clearly, when any jurisdiction, any state, any country, when you can identify a group of people and label them as other, and it's usually, not always, but it's usually some kind of minority, whether it's racial, religious, ethnic, gender, whatever, when you start labeling people as other or lesser, and you allow the laws to be used against these people instead of protecting them, you are on the slippery slope to horror, state killing, and genocide. And we have this in our country. It's really difficult for people to want to confront this. We all live in a society. We want to believe that we have a great country, and for the most part, we do. It's not easy to try to realize that all countries, including our own, have human rights problems. We need to be better than the act we committed tonight. We hope in our lifetime, clearly, we get politicians who, regardless of their gender or party, have the courage to realize that killing is not an answer. If a country can kill you in the name of the law, how can we be surprised that anything else is possible? Why are we surprised that situations like Tulia or Abu Ghraib or hate crimes, how can we be surprised at that when most people don't even blink an eye when their country kills? We have a lot of education to go in this country. Long way to go.
So the fault then lies with the concept that we are better than you or
that's
the other.
That's clearly right. You know, we have the mantra that there is no such thing as a lesser person, and that really is true. There are clearly differential characteristics among people, height, weight, speed, whatever, but the reality is that life is life, and all life is precious, and nothing justifies the taking of a life, and not even at the hands of the state. If a human being does that, it's egregious, it's terrible, there's no justifying it. And there's no justifying it when the state does it either, ever.
Professor Rick Halperin, Professor of Human Rights at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Sure. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, sir. Well, we've been all over the map tonight. See, the thing about it is that this is what, if Pete were here, he would say, this is a bad dude, like I was a bad dude. But Pete would be the example, and Pete's pretty scary. He's 6'4", 5". He weighs more than I do, but on the difference is you can't pinch him anywhere. Doesn't have enough loose skin or fat on him to pinch. He's gristle, muscle, and bone, and he's scary. And he's got tattoos that are scary. And he was a bad dude in Texas prisons, and something happened along the way, and he rejected the gangs, and now he's out here. And he's a great big scary pussycat, actually. And he's a regular on the prison show, and he's trying to remember and encourage his friends in prison by coming down here and saying, hey, dude, I miss you, but I don't miss the place. And there's something in his transition that is a lesson for us all. But gangs, the mentality that results in gangs, is never a pretty picture. And we're excited about having Patricia Harrington, who is the director of the Houston Anti-Gang Office, which is part of Homeland Security, right? In
correct.
The mayor's office of Houston.
Public Safety and Homeland Security, out of the mayor's office, yes.
All right. Patricia, tell us what you do and why you do it.
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to join you this evening on the show and just tell you a little bit about our office. The Mayor's Anti-Gang Office is a civilian program service office, and we provide prevention and intervention services for delinquent, gang-involved, and at-risk youth and their families with our goal of getting them to cease their gang involvement or decrease it as much as they can. Decrease, but eventually to cease, and you're right, reject the gang overall.
Yeah, well, after they get to prison, you know, it's got to throw it in reverse and get that. And that GRAD program, you're familiar with the GRAD program?
I am familiar with GRAD, yes.
And Rosie, who is active
sure.
in that, and,
mm-hmm.
and other people that is active. The reversal after they get in the institution, but you're actually trying to deal with more early upfront stuff.
Correct.
Right?
We're trying to work with prevention. We promote a strategy overall for the city of prevention, intervention, and then enforcement when it's necessary. And my office is really focusing on prevention, which is education based. It's educating youth on the dangers and consequences of gang involvement. It's educating their parents and teachers and other caregivers and folks who are family members on the warning signs of gang involvement. And then it's also educating the public as well on if maybe they have gangs in their community or warning signs and so on. So lots of education, prevention programming. Intervention is once the kids are already involved in the gang, and then they want out. Now they've realized they've made a bad choice. They don't want to live that lifestyle anymore, but they don't always know where to turn to for assistance on how to get out of the gang. And they're somewhat of a specialized population, so there are usually not a lot of service agencies that will take on gang-involved youth. When you're dealing with a delinquent youth, maybe a truant or a curfew or a fighter or whatever, a lot of times you're just dealing with that individual youth. But when they're in a gang, now you have to deal with the youth and the gang and the culture that they have surrounded themselves with that. So those are the two focus areas that our office promotes.
I was reading case history today about a man who's in prison and has gone through the gang rejection program, and he's writing outside explaining all this to people. And he said when he was about 13 years old, he kept reminding his mother that she should be saving money to bury him.
Hmm.
Because of his gang involvement, convinced that he was not going to live
mm-hmm.
long
sure.
enough.
Sure. I would say a lot of the gang involved, the kids that are in, they're already clicked in, they're already in the gang. That they have a whole culture, a whole mentality, and I would definitely say
that. Is it that fatalistic?
I think in their minds it is, and it can be, until they hit that teachable moment where they've realized that they've made a mistake and they want a life choice. Usually that comes from violence that has occurred to them or someone in their family or another person who's in the gang. Maybe they've gotten married or maybe they've had children. A lot of times children are what make them want to turn their lives around so that they can provide better lives for their children. They don't want their children to go up that way. And so those are usually some of the factors that make them want to turn out of the gang and reject it.
Well, you know, my experience with children is somewhat limited, but I did help parents go into an institution where a 13-year-old girl had just had a baby. She was an inmate in a juvenile institution, and getting her parents in for that occasion was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Took me dealing with lots of bureaucrats and all that. And so I went in with them, and she was laying there with the baby in her arms, which was going to be given up to her family. And she said, "I'm so glad I had this baby before I died." What the hell is wrong with the society of the 13-year-old girl?
Sure.
Think she's got to have a baby before she dies.
Right. Well, there are, you know, there's a lot of different reasons why kids turn to gangs. And, you know, we, out of our office, the anti-gang office, that's primarily our population. Our target age is our, you know, elementary school to high school. We do work with some young adults. So I would say, you know, up to maybe 21, 24 years old. And we do, again, focus on prevention, intervention, and with a lot of youth and young adults, again, who are ready to make the transition out of the gang. There are some gang members who, you know, case managing, you know, helping them find jobs, tattoo removal, and so on, which are some of the services that we do provide.
Tattoo removal is a big deal.
Yeah, it is. But what I'm trying to say is it works for some of them, but not for all of them. Some of them are not going to reject. They're in, and that's their lifestyle choice, and that's the way that they're going to die eventually or become incarcerated. We're trying to focus on those kids who have realized that they don't want to live that life anymore. They want a better life for themselves and for their family, and that's who we're trying to do the outreach and work to.
Well, spinning up something Rick Halpern said that fascinated me a few minutes ago when we were interviewing him. He said he agreed with me that the problem was found in some of us thinking we were better than others. And isn't that really a kind of a macrocosm of the gang thing? The Denver Harbor hooligans are tougher, meaner, and better than the East End hooligans? Isn't that mentality part of the picture?
It is sometimes, you know, like with any other issue or area, there isn't one or two sort of defined reasons or ways or, you know, it just depends. And so, yeah, a lot of times they're arguing over turf. You know, I live on this neighborhood and this is my neighborhood, or there it's a color. You know, I'm a Crip, I'm a Blood, you know, whatever. So, you know, a lot of those. There is a lot of that mentality. Yes, there can be. There can, but it's not. There isn't just one reason or I guess reason for why they would join. There's a lot of different social and individual risk factors why kids join. So some of the social risk factors. I was making some notes when the other guests were talking, but you know, things like where you grew up. Poverty is a big issue. A lot of times, kids don't have. You know, they know what a normal social moray would be, but if they're not seeing it, a lot of pro-social role modeling. If they're not actually seeing it, then they themselves don't know how to display it. So social risk factors. And then, of course, there's, you know, very traditional individual risk factors for kids joining. Peer pressure, you know, their friends are in and they want to be accepted. Respect is always usually a big reason why they want to join. Recognition, good or bad, you know, they want to be recognized and acknowledged for behavior, whether it's good or bad. And if they're not, you know, doing well academically, they're not in sports or recreation activities where they excel, then they're going to take the next thing, which is, okay, I'm going to be a cut-up, I'm going to be a truant, I'm going to use drugs, I'm going to be a gang member so that I can get respect and recognition from that among my peers. Access to drugs, weapons, sex is another reason why they do it. No family involvement. A lot of times the kids, they come from divorced families, incarcerated parents who are incarcerated as well. So there are quite a few different reasons, either mostly in combination, why kids would look to turn to gangs.
And then there is the pain of abuse.
Absolutely. Yes, that is another factor as well. Absolutely.
I was talking with Marilyn Gambrell, who is a saint, the No More Victims organization over in Northeast Houston, a remarkable woman who's done the same remarkable work now for more than 26 years.
Sure.
She's 28 years. She's been at this a long time. She just graduated 14 kids from high school, and getting kids to graduate from high school is a big deal in gang reduction and in children at risk of incarceration. That's important work, and she's doing it. And I met her some 25, 26 years ago.
Yes, I'm familiar with her and her work, and absolutely I would say she is a huge advocate for that, and she's just done wonderful work. So, yes, I agree.
And there's a documentary film that's going to be in our film festival about her and her work. But as we were talking, we were analyzing when fathers who have children too early and then go to prison for too long, and their wives stay out here, take care of the kids, and develop kind of as best they can. But they develop, whereas the men in prison are emotionally and mentally teenagers. And they get out, and they're old men grizzled with abuse. And there's another teenager in the house, and it's not their wife. And the risk of abuse is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And just these cultural gestalts that says it's not just execution that we're doing wrong. We should be spending so much more in prevention. And that is a more complicated issue. The governor of the state of Texas, Rick Perry, has just designated considerable funds for youth at risk. Big funds. I looked over something of how it's going to be allocated, and though I may disagree with some of the details, there is money there for research and treatment and gathering statistics and doing things. I want you to give our appreciation and thanks to the mayor for his having you in this important position and sharing with us. We will no doubt call on you again. And so we're growing to the end of our show. We will be back, unfortunately, in 2 days. There's another execution in which the, Rick call them, the condemned, has issued notice that he did not want to proceed with his appeal. He's ready to call it quits. But Michael Rodriguez is one of the 7 escapees from the Connolly unit, and he has decided to give up on his appeals and be executed, and that's going to happen Thursday. I am Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston HD2 channel. I want to thank Otis McClay for hooking the wires together and making the microphones work as well as they did. I've got to thank Elizabeth Stein for the fine work that she has done in producing this show. She puts out a lot of effort identifying our guests and gathering together. Jim Skelton, you're just a wizard and a friend, and I appreciate you're coming down here and making this work.
Way, I've known you for years, and I'd always help. You know that.
I appreciate that. And thank you very much, Patricia Harrington, for coming in. The professors, Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University Criminal Justice School. I was up there lecturing a class just a couple of weeks ago, me and a former convict, John Endo, and I. And we had such a good time lecturing the class, we came back and we put it on Houston Access Media. So you can see that in the reruns at Houston Media Source. And since they're coming up for a move, they're going to be playing lots of reruns. So thanks to the city of Houston for making that possible. And Dennis Longmire and Rick Halpern. Rick is a longstanding friend and an activist in criminal justice. His work in the Human Rights Department of SMU, which is those Wesleyans have got human rights right there in the curriculum, and having him on the show was valuable. And I want to thank you. It's not easy to listen to an HD2 channel when there are not many HD2 radios out there. So a lot of you have wired us up through the computer, and you've gotten in, and you're listening, and some of you are going to be listening on the replay on the archive. If you've got time on Friday nights, 9 o'clock Houston time, we have the prison show, and coming up this coming weekend at Rice Media Center, the Criminal Justice Reform Film Festival. I'm Ray Hill. Thank you for being with us.